With current market conditions the toughest they've been in decades, every marketing professional plays a critical role in acquiring, winning, and retaining customers. In his book, Secrets of the Marketing Masters, Dick Martin, a former AT&T public relations executive, shows how companies can prioritize, reinvigorate, and prove their marketing department to themselves, the company, and the competition. In the book, Martin explores the best advice of a variety of marketing gurus, from headhunters and ad agency heads to academics, consultants, and the masters themselves. He's our guest today on the Middle Chamber Books Podcast, and I'm your host, Steve Lubetkin. Hello and welcome to the Middle Chamber Books and Music Podcast. I'm your podcast host, Steve Lubetkin. I'm the bookseller at Middle Chamber Books. We're an Amazon.com affiliate bookstore on the web at middlechamberbooks.com. Our guest today, Dick Martin, was formerly Executive Vice President of Public Relations and Brand Management for AT&T. He's written for such publications as the Harvard Business Review, Business Week Online, Chief Executive, and Leader to Leader. He's also the author of two other books, Tough Calls and Rebuilding Brand America. And he joined us over Skype from his home in Summit, New Jersey. Dick Martin, thanks for joining us on the Middle Chamber Books Podcast.
My pleasure, Steve. It's good to be with you.
So, Dick, tell us a little bit about the Secrets of the Marketing Masters. You've been writing books for a number of years now, and what made you think of this topic, and how did you get started with it?
Well, marketing is something that's always fascinated me ever since I was at AT&T. When I finished my second book, which was Rebuilding Brand America, I had interviewed a number of marketing people in the process of doing that research, and I began reflecting on what they had told me, and it suddenly dawned on me that even though at that point I had only been out of the business for 5 years, more had changed in that 5 years than in the previous 50, I thought. I mean, for example, when I retired in 2003, which wasn't that long ago, Facebook didn't exist, Twitter didn't exist, YouTube didn't exist. It was an entirely new media landscape. People's habits, patterns of behavior, everything had changed. And marketing was kind of in turmoil. So I thought it'd be interesting to talk to some of the real leaders in marketing, well-known names as well as unfamiliar names, and just talk to them about how they were coping with all these changes, what lessons they had learned, and what was new. My publisher thought it was a good idea, so I spent the next year and a half talking to people who seemed to really know what they were doing and were successful marketers.
How did you choose the people that you profile in the book?
Well, I started by talking to executive recruiters. My prior experience had taught me that they often have their fingers on the pulse of what's happening in an industry, and they know who the bright up-and-coming executives are and who the real thought leaders are. So I talked to executive recruiters from Spencer Stuart and Korn Ferry and Russell Reynolds, a whole bunch of them. I read all the trade media I could find, not only in advertising and marketing, but also in different industries, pharmaceutical industry, the liquor industry, all kinds of industries. And I began compiling a list of about, I guess I had about 100 names at one point, and I started doing research on them. The internet's a wonderful thing. It's amazing what you can find out about people. And I narrowed it down to about a dozen people whose names came up frequently. And then it was just a matter of trying to get them to agree to talk to me. And I succeeded with a number of them. And in fact, a number of some very big names, as well as people who were less familiar but had interesting stories. So I did in-depth interviews with those people over the course of about, I don't know, 9 months.
Now, most of these folks who are regarded as highly successful in marketing are often highly successful because they keep that competitive edge over the competition by not giving up their secrets. How did you persuade them to participate in a project like this?
Well, actually, what I discovered was it wasn't that hard. Once they agreed to talk, they were perfectly willing to give me as many secrets as they could, because it turned out that the secrets weren't all that secret.
They weren't things that, it wasn't a secret sauce. It wasn't like they had a formula that
nobody else had discovered. It's just the way they applied those formulas, and especially how they really went down to the roots of marketing and rethought what it was all about in this new environment. And it was something that they were teaching to their own organization, so they were more than happy to share it with us.
What were some of the key takeaways? What are in the book? You talk about things like running marketing as a professional service.
Yeah, well, I looked at it from a number of different perspectives. You know, this was a book that was intended not only for marketers in the consumer space, but also business-to-business marketers, and not only large companies, but also small companies. So I looked at it from a number of different angles. One of the things that struck me the deeper I got into this was how public relations, which was the field in which I had spent 30 some odd years, and marketing were melding. You know, in my days at AT&T, there was always a war between PR and marketing. The marketing was always trying to take over PR's turf, and PR was always trying to edge in on marketing. Those wars are over, pretty much. And the marketing people have begun to realize that consumers are now very interested in the company behind a product, which, of course, is what PR people had been focused on all the time I was in public relations. And so there was really a melding of the two disciplines.
So in terms of some of the other secrets that people were willing to give up?
Well, the importance of knowing your purpose, that sounds sort of commonsensical, but what they meant by that was your purpose has to be something more than gaining market share or meeting next quarter's profit targets. Your purpose really has to center on what you're doing for a customer. And that means really understanding the customer at a nitty-gritty level. And that was one of the secrets to the success of Procter & Gamble. P&G invented market research, but in 2000, when a new chairman took over, he realized that the lessons and the patterns of behavior that had made them a leader in the 20th century were no longer going to suffice in the 21st century. He hired a young marketing guy named Jim Stengel to be the chief marketing officer of the company. And Stengel began to realize that all of their brand managers were drowning in data, but they didn't know the customer. Very few of them ever spent any time with the customer. In fact, the brand managers responsible for Pampers didn't have kids and didn't know anything about raising a kid, diapering a kid, teaching a kid to be toilet trained, and so forth. And so he told them to shove aside all of these reams of data that cluttered their desk and get out of their office and spend time with real live customers. So they did. They followed them around the supermarket. They visited them in their homes when they did their housework, watched them do the laundry, watched them diaper the babies. And when they came back together, they began to realize that they were playing a much more important role in people's lives than they had suspected. The Pampers people, for example, had been obsessed with fluid absorption technology. They were all about babies' bottoms. But it suddenly dawned on them that diapers were really another form of clothing and that they could affect the baby's health. If a baby slept well through the night, its brain developed better, it was a healthier baby, and diapers could play a role in helping babies sleep through the night. When a baby or toddler gets toilet trained, it's a very big deal in a parent's life. It's something that is celebrated. In fact, they began to think of diapers as just another form of clothing rather than as a sponge to absorb human waste. And that caused them to rethink the way they designed the diapers, the way they marketed the diapers, to really rethink what the purpose of diapers were in their the moms and dads' lives and the baby's life. And as a result, Pampers is now a huge product for P&G. In fact, P&G sells more baby products than Johnson & Johnson and Gerber's combined. And it's because they really reconnected with the higher purpose of their products. This whole notion of higher purpose is something that Jim Stengel discovered and spread through the company and was happy to share with me for this book.
It's really kind of an interesting evolution in marketing, because they spent so many years relying on the numbers. And even, you know, in the Wall Street area where I came from, you know, everybody focused on the numbers and neglected the so-called shoe leather research of what you just described, going out and seeing how people actually use the product, or in the case of, you know, financial instruments, how financial instruments led to, you know, municipalities being able to build bridges and schools and so forth. But, you know, I think about companies like Intuit, which spends a lot of time watching how people use its financial software and understanding how they use it. You think that this is like a big revelation for marketers today?
Well, yeah, I think it is, because, well, and it's easy to get focused on the wrong thing and to be sort of swept along by the momentum of the way things are always done. And that's what happened at places like P&G. Scott Cook, who was the CEO of Intuit and the guy who invented Quicken, really started out by watching people do their finances, writing checks. And yeah, that's how he came up with the idea for the product. Now, that isn't to say that marketers can get by with mother-in-law research or hanging around at the supermarket. That's important to get a visceral feel for what your customers' needs, wants, and values and aspirations are. But you do need quantitative research to confirm that. And P&G didn't give up on the quantitative research. They still do plenty of that. But it's balanced by this personal experience with customers.
There's been an extraordinary evolution, as you mentioned. You touched on at the beginning of the conversation about social networks and social media and the kind of communities that people are building online, many of them around their passion for products and companies and being fans and getting badges and things like that. And you talk a little bit about building communities in the book. Harley Davidson's an example of a company you cite that is doing a good job of building community among its customers. Talk a little bit about how communities are important today.
Yeah, it's, you know, P&G was named the marketer of the century for the 20th century, and that was entirely based on advertising. P&G was the largest advertiser in the world in the 20th century. They trailblazed all kinds of new media. You know, soap operas came out of P&G. But in the 21st century,
one of the other secrets I discovered
is that it's not about advertising anymore. It's about relationships. It's about community. The irony is that initially, a lot of marketers used the social media as if it was just another network. You know, they shoveled ads onto it. They tried to figure out, how can we put a 30-second commercial on Facebook and get people to watch it? And they really misunderstood the whole function of social media. Social media doesn't exist so that marketers can come into contact with their customers. Social media exists so their customers can come into contact with each other. And the smart marketers are the ones who find ways to help their customers build these communities around a shared interest that they have. But the communities are communities of customers. They're not a device
for marketers to intrude
into a customer's life. And in fact, those marketers who have tried to do that have gone down in flames. Today, the smart marketers like Harley Davidson and American Express facilitate the building of communities, so they empower their customers. and they allow those communities to have an equal voice in the marketer's business. So Dell, for example, which was one of the companies that went down in flames in social media, completely turned itself around and now has some of the best social media practices in the industry. And they did that by empowering their customers. They let their customers ask questions of high-level experts in Dell. They let their customers criticize them openly, and they respond honestly to the criticisms they get. They let their customers give them ideas for product improvements. I mean, Dell has just turned the thing completely around because they understand that the strategy is to facilitate the building of real communities with total transparency.
So many companies don't get that, and so many companies seem to be afraid of that engagement with their customers. You've got an awful lot of years of sitting at the management table hearing the concerns. Why do you think so many companies are afraid to let their customers have a freewheeling conversation with them?
Well, it's really a new way of thinking. And the first thing that companies need to truly believe is that the customers are in control. And that's more true today than it ever was. I mean, customers are control. The company doesn't own the brand. The customers own the brand. And companies, it takes a leap of faith, you know, to let your customers exercise that control. And it's not without risks. But the companies that do it, I think, are reaping the benefits.
One of the questions that comes up a lot in conversations about social media with companies is the return on investment. And everybody is understandably obsessed with financial performance, and yet it's very hard to demonstrate a connection between the two. What do you say to the marketer who says, I'd love to do this, but I have to show my boss an ROI?
Yeah, it is hard to find the return on investment for a social media program, just as it's hard to show the return on investment for a public relations program. But there's no question that you need to do it. I mean, it's just part of running a business these days. And if you don't do it, you are missing an opportunity. There are companies that have demonstrated some return on the investment, but it's sort of anecdotal.
There's no simple response to the question that says, you know, this is maybe not about ROI up front. It may be about ROI in the future, but it's about building that relationship with the customers to help cement them to the business or something like that.
Yeah. Well, once you accept the premise that relationships count more today than they ever did. In fact, McKinsey & Company says relationships count for more than product features these days. Once you accept that belief, then you look at social media as a way of building relationships, and you begin to look at indicators of the strength of your relationships with your customers by the, you know, the number of people who are in that community, their level of engagement. But it's difficult to draw a straight line that would pass the red face test with outside auditors that says, this level of engagement led to this level of profitability. I mean, that just doesn't exist. But frankly, I don't think that ever existed really for advertising either.
Are you seeing any excesses in the new social media world? In the past couple of weeks, there was an incident involving one of the major airlines inadvertently sending a bunch of customers an email that said, we're going to credit you with 1,000 frequent flyer miles. And then within a couple of days, they sent out an oops email saying, we're sorry, that was sent to you in error. We're really not giving you that. And there's been at least one commentator in the blogosphere making this into what he described as an epic fail by the company. And it seems like it was just a human error. Are we seeing more of this in the blogosphere of people trying to make things into more than they are when a company makes a mistake?
Yeah, it's much larger and more people have a megaphone. I mean, the downside of things like blogging and social media is that your customers have all this outsized power that they never had before, and some people can misuse it. The upside is that you can have a closer relationship with your customers, and you can respond appropriately when somebody is off base.
And how are companies doing in terms of responding? Are they picking it up and doing it? Or
yeah, some are. There's a danger in overreacting. Apple, for example, is not a big user of social media. They monitor the social media, but they aren't in the same league as a company like Dell or Cisco, for example, when it comes to building communities of Apple users, which is a little ironic because there probably is no more fervent, you might say fervid, community than that of Apple users.
And I would say if you probably asked Apple users about their perception of Apple in the social media, they would probably have a perception that they are there.
Well, they are there in the sense that if you go to their website and you can find a forum that will let you ask a question, and maybe in a few months you'll get an answer. But they just aren't in the same league as these other companies, where they purposely facilitate the building of communities. They're more observers, and they do the sort of the basic stuff. But they're not a big, I don't think anybody would point to Apple and say, there's an example of a company that is really excellent in the use of social media.
Were there any companies that in the course of your research that surprised you for being very effective, or surprised you because you thought they would be and turned out not to be?
The company that surprised me the most was Dell, because they were so lousy when I started researching the book. And in the course of just writing this book, they completely turned it around. And I'm still not sure exactly what happened at Dell, but now they're really an example of the right way to approach social media. P&G is an example of a company that I've used on both sides as an example of a real trailblazer and excellent company. But they've also had some mishaps in marketing. For example, they came out with a new formulation for Pampers diapers and just let it kind of slip into distribution. For logistical reasons, they had, let me back up a little bit. They had a corporate goal of reducing the amount of waste that they produced to become a more sustainable company. And so they came up with a formulation for the gel that's used in Pampers diapers that would allow them to make a much thinner diaper. They decided they would go to this new formulation, and they had plans to announce it, but it was going to take several months to get the new diapers into their distribution systems. So they started putting the new diapers into their existing packaging, waiting for the moment when they had full distribution and they could announce what it was about. Well, mothers began opening the package, found this thinner diaper, wondered what was going on, put it on their baby, and as luck would have it, some of those babies developed a diaper rash. And the diaper rashes in the minds of some mothers, because it was associated with this new thinner diaper, became chemical burns. And they started their own social media website campaigning to have Pampers bring back the old formulation, and it took months for P&G to extricate itself from this mess. What they had failed to do was to communicate
with their customers at the very beginning.
I mean, they could have put a product insert in the packaging that had the new diapers. They could have been more forthcoming with parents about what they were doing. They could have used their own social media, because there is a P&G-sponsored Pampers social media website that had something like 200,000 members. They could have used
that to communicate what they were doing. All sorts of things they could have done. They didn't do any of it,
because they wanted to have this turn all the wind machines on when they were ready to make their announcement. Now, the great irony of this is that when P&G had introduced a new fabric softener that was a sheet that you threw in the dryer, they realized that there were dryer fires on a regular basis. There was something like a couple of thousand a month across the United States, and they were worried that their customers might think that these dryer fires were due to the sheet of fabric softener that was being thrown into the dryer. So they did a very good communications job. But there are 2,500 cases of diaper rash every day in the United States, and yet it didn't dawn on them that they should do the same kind of communication.
Any companies that weren't here for the traditional marketing era that are now here and have put the structures in place better than the old line companies? You mentioned Zappos in the book.
Yeah, Zappos, thank you. I was trying to think of an example. Yeah, Zappos is built on the structure of a community. Tony Hsieh, in fact, has written his own book now outlining the Zappos approach to marketing. And it's really all word-of-mouth marketing and giving customers what they call a wow experience and empowering the people who are on the phone in their call centers. In fact, they spend 3 weeks training their people to answer the phone and represent Zappos in taking orders. And at the end of that training, they tell the people who have made it through that they'll give them $1,000 not to take the job, because they only want people who really want to work for Zappos and are willing to pass up $1,000. They'd rather work at Zappos. And so they have some of the most engaged employees that you'll ever see.
And now we've entered the age where presidential candidates like Mitt Romney are announcing their plans on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I wonder what the implications are for marketing in the future. What do you see marketers doing to take further advantage of these new technologies going forward?
Well, the technology keeps changing, and it's moving faster than it ever did, and marketers are always playing a game of catch up with the technology. So it's hard to predict what they're going to do next. In the world of politics, many politicians are using social media. A lot of people say that it was one of the key factors in President Obama's successful presidential campaign. And indeed it was. But it's also easy to misunderstand what he did. He didn't use social media as a form of advertising. He didn't even really use social media as a way of his getting his message to his followers. He used it as a way of connecting his followers to each other and giving them the information they needed to represent him. And the smart marketers are using social media exactly that way. They are completely rethinking the old one-to-many model that advertising represented and adopting a many-to-many model, which is really what social media is all about.
Well, we know, Dick, that you've been extremely prolific as an author, and certainly this is not going to be the last book that we see from you. What have you got working in the pipeline? Can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah, I'm finishing up a manuscript right now that'll be out in 2012, and the title is Otherwise: The Importance of Developing the Wisdom of Relating to the Other. I think one of the big issues of our day is the fragmentation and polarization in society, and has serious implications for business. If you think of business in the 21st century, it's all about globalization. It's all about the changing demography of our own country. You know, we're becoming a minority-majority country, a multicultural, multigenerational country. And there are people who think that the solution is micro-targeting. I'm not so sure. I think the solution is really understanding others in a way that is profoundly different, that goes way beyond tolerance and really goes all the way to becoming what I call otherwise.
Sounds great, and we look forward to seeing that, and maybe we'll have you back for a chat when the book's published.
I'd love to do it. Thank you, Steve.
Great. Dick Morton is the author of Secrets of the Marketing Masters, What the Best Marketers Do and Why It Works, and he's our guest today on the Middle Chamber Books podcast. Dick, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome, Steve. Thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this program, and if you have comments or suggestions, you can email me with those comments, and the email address is steve@middlechamberbooks.com. You can also call our podcast comment line. In the U.S., it's 856-861-6146. Don't forget to put a plus one in front of it. In the U.K. and other parts of Europe, you can call plus 440-220-7193-6146. We produce these programs in the studios of Professional Podcasts in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, on the web at professionalpodcasts.com. Our theme music for this podcast is Cook the Books, PodSafe music from the Indianapolis Jazz Orchestra. For everyone here in the studios, this is Steve Lupatkin. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.